Kings of Metal. You're jammed in the back of your older brother's 1980 Honda Civic, your head buzzing from Mountain Dew, your toes cramping in your new black boots, your eyes sticky from the excesses of eyeliner applied earlier with a shaky, inexpert hand. Your only guide, the rearview mirror and the women's magazines you read obsessively for a year back in sixth grade. Outside the car windows, the streets of Newark, New Jersey flick by. Warehouses, vacant lots, tenements bereft of people and doors. Streets that, as your father would have said, if he were still alive to say such things, look as though they've been hit with an ugly stick. To add to your discomfort, your tailbone is digging into the plastic divot in the middle of the seat, originally designed to hold fast food bags or playing cards or other traveling detritus, but instead is cradling you in its decidedly less than comfortable embrace. Its unique ability to jam you right in the coccyx over every bump and swerve in the road has earned it the apt nickname of the asshole seat, so that you do, indeed, feel like an asshole whenever forced to sit in it. Which is not often, it's true, but now that you and your brother have both reached your teens, the number of friends regularly packed into the tiny Civic has rapidly increased, and unfortunately, as a younger sister, you do not have the status necessary to claim shotgun with any sense of authority. You are flanked on either side by your brother's friends, hulking boys with longish, scraggly hair and denim vests speckled with various buttons and iron-on patches, Iron Maiden, Sepultura, Overkill. They smell vaguely of unwashed scalps and their mother's laundry detergent, a peculiar scent that has gradually worked its way into your sinuses, so that years afterward, when you recall this night, it is this smell that comes flooding back to you, the mingled odors of personal neglect and a mother's care. It's as though the smell itself embodies the very essence of adolescence, that grim struggle between dependence and independence, push, pull, push, pull. Behind you in the hatchback, knees crooked and head bent low by the car's roof, sits another boy, equally patched and denimed, Kyle McKinney, whom you will always remember as the one who mercilessly ground your face into a pile of snow during a snowball fight one frozen and raucous night some 5 years prior, when you still lived in Greenwich Village just before your family moved upstate. You were 9 then, quite unschooled in matters of the heart, so that even this cruel act was not enough to quench the slender and hopeful flame you then carried for him in your narrow, unbudded chest. It was only a few months later, when you noticed the flare-up of pimples along his forehead and the way his socks would always dangle gracelessly off his toes whenever he took off his shoes, that you felt this flame flicker and die within you. But even after that small death, you found it hard to ignore the mean ones, the boys who might laugh at you in the middle school hallways for the oversized glasses you had then, or flip your lunch tray on its side or shoot spitballs in your direction during math class. The ones with the flat eyes and the chipped smiles and the hair that would always flop just so on their brows. Even now, at 14, you are in love with such a boy, another long-haired boy who, though no less cruel, sometimes brings you a rose from the Walgreens on Route 209 or a piece of jewelry, always silver because he knows you dislike gold, from the Hudson Valley Mall. This boy, however, is not with you tonight, having not been allowed by his mother to travel down to New York, or the city, as upstate denizens call it, where the so far fruitless trip to Newark began over 2 hours before. At first you thought you would miss having him with you, but have since realized that you do not. He would, after all, have been simply another body crowded in upon you, squashing you further down into the asshole seat. Up front, in the coveted passenger seat, sits your brother's closest friend, Sean, who has ice blue eyes, a smile that could just as easily be a leer, and a grandmother you used to glimpse in the neighborhood, shuttling between Morton and Barrow Streets with her metal pushcart, her yellow-white hair matted into a single thick knot against the back of her head. This was before either you or your brother knew her as the grandmother of his future closest friend, so that then she was just another crazy old lady in the village, someone to marvel at, and perhaps to pity. Even now she is an object of pity, though you have also learned that she is a poet, which you have recently discovered you are too, that her son, Sean's father, died a homeless alcoholic, that she loves her grandson, and that she has no idea how to raise him. It is perhaps her ineptitude as a foster parent that has led to Sean's privileged position in the passenger seat. It is his apartment, after all, to which you all flock on a regular basis. He and his grandmother share two apartments on the third floor of a standard village walk-up on Barrow Street. The apartments face each other across the hall, but they are separate. She lives in the one facing the street, he in the one abutting the courtyard. You and your brother each envy him his independence, as do the others. Presuming he needs his privacy, his grandmother never enters his apartment, allowing it to fill up with trash and old food and teenagers with big boots and denim vests. It is this unfettered indulgence allowed by Sean's separate apartment that has lent him leadership over the small group in your brother's car, earning him the luxury of the front seat, while the rest of you squirm and shift in the back. You hope to reach your destination soon, but none of you know exactly when that will be. You are all out of your element, beyond city and state boundaries, in the uncharted territory of New Jersey, driving through Newark among the desolation of its empty gas stations and busted streets, looking for a Manowar concert you have all been anticipating for weeks. In Sean's apartment before setting out, you and the cluster of boys blasted Kings of Metal, the newest Manowar cassette, on his stereo, banging your bushy heads in rhythm, the boys secretly wishing, or so you imagined, they too could sport the bulging pectorals and rippled abdomen of the proud singer astride the tape cover, sword jutting outward, lightning bolts jaggedly ripping the sky behind him. You have yet to memorize the lyrics of the new songs, but you know the music, so that you've been quietly humming it to yourself throughout the journey down Hudson Street, through the Holland Tunnel, across the highways to the fluorescent-lit and shadow-stained expanses of Newark. The opening band was due to start at 8, the next at 9, and Manowar at 10, so that, though it is already 9:30, you do still have time. But it is 1989, before the dawn of GPS, and you only have a street address, which may or may not be correct. Newark has turned out to be hopelessly confusing, and you are all beginning to realize how truly lost you are. Your brother has been trying to take charge, which is a new role for him, but as the driver, one he apparently feels required to fill. Over the past few hours, he has gamely accelerated and braked and turned, craning his neck to examine street signs, pausing to gaze down possible alleys, even getting out of the car occasionally to ask directions at various corner delis and gas stations, which, before your mother handed the car down to him, he would have never done. But to no avail. His patience, like all of yours, is growing thin, and he has begun to snap at everyone except Sean, whom he reveres. You can tell, even from your cramped position in the back, that he is about ready to give up. You can see it in the particular bend of his neck, the slant of his head with its cascade of blonde hair. It is the same posture he adopts whenever he is ready to surrender. You've seen it countless times, sitting over his algebra homework at the kitchen table, standing at the fringes of a failing soccer match at day camp, climbing a tree at your grandparents' summer home in Cape Cod, before realizing how far up it reached. The way his head bends down, like a bough in a strong wind, as though he is succumbing to all the forces beyond his control. It is the same stance he settled into 3 years before, during the last few months of your father's life, when the breath rattled in your father's throat and his legs thinned down to sticks. You saw it whenever you all sat down to dinner and your brother gazed across the table, his fork poised midway to his mouth, his eyes settling on your father's wasted face. Whenever he walked into the room where your father sat, heating pad against his broken chest, his lungs struggling to cough up the cancer eating away at them. That gradual slant, that slow slope of his neck, bending to the weight of the world upon him. You know what it means then, this bend of his head, but you don't want to, not now, because making it to this concert has suddenly taken on all the importance of life and death. You need this concert, need it in the marrow of your bones, the beat of your blood, the soft and resonant places of your young and untried body. You need the crush of bodies, the tumult of flesh on flesh, the deep thrum of the bass within you, the crash of drums. You have never needed anything the way you need this type of music, these kinds of concerts. It started a year before in eighth grade with Guns N' Roses and Judas Priest, and then quickly progressed under the influence of your brother and Sean to Metallica, to Testament, to Slayer. Over a year ago, you would have scorned this music, even feared it. But now it fills something within you, something raw and gaping, fills it like concrete fills a hole, makes you feel solid, uncrushable. Now it is your younger self you scorn, the self that cried over Tiffany songs at middle school dances, that stayed alone in her room with her copy of Little Women, that let herself weaken and flicker in the wake of her father's death. Metal has wiped all that away. You have never felt so vivid, so thoroughly within the moment than you do at these shows. Standing in the crowd before the band starts, the swell of people, the rise in anticipation, the way the sweat begins to roll down your sides before the first chords are even struck, your chin lifted toward the stage like a baby sparrow's beak towards its mother. So many times, older girls, ones with slashes of makeup and wildly teased hair, have noticed you in the crowd before the shows. Your round cheeks, your flat hair, your body that has yet to grow as theirs have, and have bent down towards you, a maternal glaze settling on their faces, and cautioned you, told you how rough it would get, tried to lead you away, but you have always stood your ground, shrugged off their concern, fixed your gaze once more upon the stage. And when it has started, you've always been right up there with the rest of them, caught in the crush, spinning from pit to pit, arms joyfully flailing, all else utterly forgotten. Now, noticing the way your brother's head has settled into its pose of defeat, a resurgence of hope grips you, a fierce and sudden urge to find the concert, no matter what. You lean forward, bumping your tailbone anew on the plastic seat, and look out past the shaggy shapes of the boys, out past the windows of the tiny car in which your family used to travel upstate to the land you owned then, back when you were all a family going on a camping trip, laughing at the brown bags by the side of the road, which from a distance looked so much like woodchucks, so that you would all begin a collective sigh of approval upon spotting them, only to discover upon closer inspection that what had seemed a cute and fuzzy creature was merely a discarded bit of trash. Back then, with only the four of you, you, your brother, your mother, your father, the car never seemed too small, not the way it does now, so overloaded it is an effort even to gaze out the window, but you do, somehow, you manage it. Leaning forward, realizing suddenly how much you have to pee, you scan the streets searching for a sign of the concert that may or may not save your life. At first you see nothing, only more empty streets, but then you spot an alcove, and deep in its recesses, a door. Look, you say, pointing. Maybe that's it. Oh, shit. Your brother leans forward, presses his foot to the accelerator. Oh, shit. Man of fucking war, shouts Kyle McKinney from the back, the same triumphant edge in his voice that was there the night he smashed your face into the snow. Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah, Sean says softly. He leans forward as your brother has, their profiles in tandem, looking ahead. Your heart begins to patter as the car moves forward, closer to the door in the alcove. Already you can feel the music, its deep bass, the crash of the cymbals, the rising crescendo of the singer's voice as it reaches its unimaginable heights. You've already decided this will be the night you finally clamber onto the stage, as you've seen so many others do before. This will be the night you pull yourself up there, in front of everybody, in your new boots and your streaked eyeliner, to raise your fist in triumph before hurling yourself forward out over the crowd, to be caught in their collective embrace and carried, screaming with joy, over their heads and back to the melee of the pit, where it will all begin again. You've always been too scared to try this before, afraid the bouncers would catch you and throw you out, afraid that even if you did succeed in jumping, the crowd would reject you, wouldn't catch you, that you would fall defeated to the floor, ostracized, forgotten, unloved. But after seeing so many others attempt it and succeed, you have gathered your courage and made your decision. So as the car slows to a halt in front of the door, your heart's patter turns into a pounding, and you clench your hands and your smile begins to break free from your face. You'd expected something, a bouncer, a few stragglers, perhaps just a buzzy neon sign above the door. But there's nothing. It is just a door and a wall, slightly set back from the street. When you look toward the other buildings on the street, you see they also have alcoves, and these alcoves also have doors. What you have found is not the entrance to a concert, but merely a back entrance to an old factory in a row of old factories. That's it. Nothing more. Sean is the first one to slump, slouching back in his seat. His face in profile is sharp, his cheeks hollow. His chest looks suddenly caved in, sunken. You see again, as you so often do, your father's face in the last months of his life, the concavity of his own cheeks, his own chest. In those last days, the smell from his lungs got so intense you had to consciously will yourself to stay in the room with him. Now this particular odor will sometimes come back to you in odd moments, as though your memory has simply flipped a switch, shining a light back on those god-awful days. Those were the days after you moved upstate, when you all lived on a mountain, when you used to escape the house where your father sat dying and go on long walks to a nearby lake, where sometimes you would throw stones into the water and sometimes you would not. The horror of what was happening was so strong it was difficult even to cry, as though your tears were stopped up inside you, so that you would force yourself to because you thought you were supposed to. You would crouch by the lake, throwing stones in or not, and whisper to yourself, after he came out of remission and after the doctor's prediction, whisper over and over, just 1 year, just one measly year. Whisper it to yourself there in the dark until you could make the tears come. He didn't even last a year, though, just 6 months or so. And then one Sunday morning, he coughed up blood in his office at home and died before either you or your mother could reach him. And that, as they say, was that. Your brother, too, has slumped, but has not sat back, only draped his arms over the steering wheel. You cannot see his face, just his hair, long and blonde, and a point of pride with him. Years from now, though not that many, he will begin to lose this hair, first in a patch on the crown of his head, and then in a wide spread across his skull. He will have already begun to shave his head, so that it will not be that evident, but evident enough. By that time, he will have given up hope of filling the role of leader, will have retreated into a hermitage of his own devising, doing landscaping with his friend's mother, and living alone in the basement of a house in the woods. Three cats, no girlfriends, and a growing pile of empty rum bottles by the door. He will seem happy, or at least content, but sometimes, in the night, after too many drinks, he will fall down, alone in the dark, and bruise a shin, twist an ankle, scrape some skin off an elbow. His hair will eventually disappear completely, exposing a skull increasingly patched with disturbing red spots that he will insist are from sunburn. They will instead deepen and spread, so that every time you see him, you will see the early death hovering just behind his shoulder. He too, like your father, will smell, but not like cancer, not yet, only like cigarettes and cats and basement and unwashed clothes, so that, as it was with your father, it will be hard to stay in the same room with him, and you will have less patience for it. Sean, too, will retreat, though in a different way. Not 1 year from this night, he will stop fighting the legacy of his alcoholic father and let his apartment, his coveted apartment, symbol of adulthood, fill up with not only friends and boots and leather, but also bottles of whiskey and vodka and tequila. After that will come various drugs and then heroin, to which Sean will become addicted for years, leading him, after his grandmother's death, to break into his neighbor's apartment and steal $1,000 worth of electronics in order to feed his habit. This, in turn, will begin his cycle in and out of jail, Rikers Island to an upstate prison to freedom, and then, after relapse and another theft, back again. Your brother will lose touch with Sean at first, a loss he will mourn as all lost friends are mourned. But once Sean tracks down his number and calls him years later, he will wish he hadn't. By then, after long years in and out of jail, Sean will have become just a nuisance, a petulant, a needy, middle-aged man with a heavily creased face and a surfeit of tattoos, the type of man who always needs money or a patient ear. He will call over and over again, filling up your brother's voicemail with endless messages about his problems, his needs, his regrets, calling so often and so persistently that your brother will eventually stop answering the phone. And you? What about you, poised on the cusp of the asshole seat, feeling the first drops of disappointment deep in your gut as you stare at that resolutely closed and indifferent door? First, in your near future, there is a boy. Tonight, you have almost forgotten he exists, that long-haired boy with the flat, cruel eyes and gifts of cheap jewelry, the one whose mother wouldn't let him come with you on this journey. But you will remember, and you will return to him, return to your fumblings with him under the covers in your mother's house, and his, which have so far only included a lot of wet kissing and a rather unpleasant, due to his long fingernails, bit of groping and prodding. Only a few months from now, you will lose your virginity to him, which will bring you both relief and panic. Relief because you have long ached to join the ranks of those no longer in the dark about such aspects of life, and panic because you will think at first, due to a broken condom, that you are pregnant, but will luckily discover after an appropriate amount of time that you're not. After this, there will be a string of unsuitable boyfriends and even worse girlfriends, until eventually you will end up marrying one of your brother's friends, as though your time banging heads with your brother and Sean and the others before metal concerts will be a sort of prediction for what you need in life. It is as though your family broken early, you will find yourself unable to stray too far from the family circle, reluctant to find love too far from what you know, from what is known about you. At some point, you will get a job, a few jobs, one after the other, and acquire what you think you need in life, your husband, an apartment, a dog. You will have long since stopped listening to metal, will have replaced it with other interests, other music. You will feel happy, more or less, but sometimes, on particular mornings, when you rise from the subway on Rector Street in New York, not too many miles from where you failed to find the Man of War concert, when you emerge blinking into the dawn on your way to work and see the first sun just glancing off the skyscrapers, you will recall what it felt like to be 14 in melting makeup and boots that were too tight for you, crammed between unwashed boys in search of a show you were destined not to find. You will think of a line you read once. She was a poet with a poet's sensibilities. And you will wonder when you stopped writing poetry and why, and if Sean's grandmother, with her thick and matted hair, kept writing it up to the very end. But all this is in the future. Now, on this night, there you all are, staring at that door in a row of doors. Collectively, without even having to say it aloud, you realize that your search has come to an end. There will be no Man of War tonight, no mosh pit, no stage diving, no Kings of Metal. All you can do is turn around and head back to New York, to the city, as you two have recently begun to call it. Your brother, still at this point the brave pilot, heads out of Newark and onto the highways he hopes will lead back to Sean's apartment. Beyond Newark, the highways are empty, and you think at first you will make it back without further incident. But bad luck continues to plague the packed Honda Civic, so that your brother cannot seem to locate the correct path back to New York. He takes one wrong exit, then another, merging onto roads none of you remember from the trip out, and you find yourselves just as lost as you were in Newark. At first, this bothers you, bothers all of you, so that again the tension rises in the car, the back of your brother's head straining with the effort. But then, at some point, on a highway none of you ever knew existed, Sean blurts out, "Nostratap," and bursts into laughter. At first, you are all mystified, but then, as he points gleefully at the road sign passing over your heads, you realize what he is doing. Nostratap is Patterson, spelled backward, an infinitely more interesting and enjoyable name, opening up possibilities of which you have not yet dreamed. It takes only a moment before you are all doing it. Awatot, Nodala, Summer Rap, the most wonderful and ridiculous names, as though you have suddenly entered another world, like the ones in the books you read as a child. Dewage Deer, where it is always summer. Kiwidlaw, where owls are kings and nobody ever goes hungry. Each new name warrants a new outburst of laughter, a fresh challenge to outdo the last one. And then, to your shared delight, out pop places that need no arrangement to sound absurd. Weehawken, Mawa, the completely wonderful discovery of Hohokus. Your stomach hurts from laughing so hard. Even your brother is smiling. Sean's face is scarlet, tears running down his face, which, though cold, is still young. You are somewhere unknown, farther north than you should be. But in that moment, as your brother searches in vain for the roads that will lead you back to the city, your face is bright, your heart lighter than it has been in a long time, and you believe, somehow, that everything is going to be all right.